ever brought your magic to Walt Disney World like, hey, we came to play? Did you tip your tiara to a Creole princess or get goofy officially? Step up like a boss and save the day? Or see what life's like under the Tree of Life? Did you? If you could, would you? When we come through, it's true magic. 'Cause we came to play. Bring the magic at Walt Disney World Resort.
Dietz and Watson's been making meats and cheeses the right way since forever. What's that mean? It means never cutting corners, ever. It means cooking, not processing. It means our Virginia brand ham that's cooked to perfection, then twice baked to layer the flavors. It takes more time, but you can taste the difference. We come to work every day to do it the right way, even if it's the hard way. Because if it's not right for us, it's not right for you. Dietz and Watson, it's a family thing since 1939.
Well, that was fun. In this week's edition of the Golf Central podcast presented by Callaway Golf, Rex and I break down Phil Mickelson's improbable victory at the PGA Championship and discuss all of the other action from on-site here at Kiawah Island. But before we get into all that, a word from our sponsors. The story of the year in golf unfolded over the weekend with Phil Mickelson becoming the oldest major champion in history. Not only did he become the oldest major champion, but in the process, he also recorded the longest drive of the week at number 16 on Sunday, a clutch 366-yard bomb splitting the fairway. What you may not know is that this was Phil's first week with the Callaway Epic Speed driver in his bag. Pairing his new Epic Speed driver with his Callaway Chrome Soft Triple Track golf ball, Lefty is a major champion once again. All right, Rex, we are doing this live Sunday night of the PGA Championship. You are driving home. Your son has a graduation to attend on Monday morning, and you do as well. I'm sitting in my one-bedroom villa, just like we were on Wednesday night when we previewed this PGA Championship. And Rex, I got to tell you, we did not mention Phil Mickelson's name once. We previewed this PGA Championship for about 50 minutes, and not once was Lefty's name mentioned. Where do you even start with what will go down as one of the historic days in the history of this sport?
I mean, we could have talked for 150 minutes last Wednesday and we wouldn't have mentioned Phil's name. I mean, and let's be honest. I mean, I'm not trying to be overly critical here, and you're absolutely right. What he did is historic, and there's a lot of ways to break this down that I think is fascinating to me. But there was nothing in his body of work that even remotely suggested that this was close. He pointed to that first round in Charlotte a couple of weeks ago, which was a great first round and gave him the lead, but then he just blew up over the next three rounds, and that's been the MO. He hasn't been able to put together back-to-back rounds for essentially 2.5 years since he won his last tour event before this event at Pebble Beach in 2019. So no, I don't feel like we have to defend ourselves, but I mean, when you look at how everything clicked, and you and I probably had this conversation 10 times over the last 4 days, like, Lefty's going to go away eventually, right? Like, we knew it. Like, this, you can't sustain this. Like, eventually he's going to throw up a 74, a 75, and he'll go away quietly. And we'll remember this as a week that, you know, Lefty showed some signs of life. I didn't even believe it. I think it's a sign of how little trust we had in Phil Mickelson, that there was a moment sort of in the scrum area and you were walking with Phil, and I want to get your thoughts on exactly what that scene was like. But we fast forward ahead, Louis Oosthuizen has finished up his round ahead of Phil. But Phil is still closing out, you know, what he has to do on 18. And Louis comes over to do his media obligations. And under normal circumstances, and granted it was a two-stroke lead, under normal circumstances, the runner-up is going to wait. He's going to see how this plays out. He's not going to come over and start – he's not going to concede the race in this particular situation. And I think it was just a testament – how little faith all of us had in Phil Mickelson. They were kind of like, I didn't do it. Like, you know, what's the worst that could happen? Oh, that last putt dropped. I think we all had some doubt, and obviously it's gone now, but it was just what we had grown to expect from Phil Mickelson.
I mean, if you think about how this week played out on Thursday, I think he shot 70 and he only talked to like Sirius XM. So we didn't even get a crack at him. as reporters. We thought, look, he opened with what, a 63 at Quail Hollow just a couple of weeks ago to take the first round lead. Like, clearly he was just going to fade from contention, just like he did in Charlotte a couple of weeks ago. And then, boy, he took the 36 hole co-lead. And I wrote the column on Friday night, essentially just like, wow, you could not have picked a worse fit for Phil than Kiawah Island, a golf course that has booby traps everywhere. You know, one of the hardest golf courses on the planet. It was literally dubbed the hardest golf course in the world, with trouble everywhere, like tall grass and water and sand and freaking alligators everywhere. Like, one of the most historically inaccurate great players of all time on that golf course. Of course that wasn't going to last. That's what I wrote Friday. Saturday, somehow Phil, you know, he keeps it together. He kind of had a bump in the road after a really hot start, played a two-hole stretch and three over par, and he's got a one-shot lead heading the final round. Well, of course he's not going to beat Brooks Koepka. Brooks Koepka, who's about 60 strokes better than any player in the majors since 2017. I mean, obviously, Koepka, even on one good leg, was going to beat Phil. And if it wasn't Koepka, well, it was obviously going to be Louis Oosthuizen, who we thought kind of just had his bad driving day and his bad putting day on Saturday. You know, maybe Kevin Streelman, maybe it's his time to get it. Maybe, hey, maybe Bryson goes low, or Spieth goes low, or Finau, or whoever. It was going to be anybody but Phil. I mean, clearly at 50 years old, not having factored in a major in 5 years without a top 10 on the PGA Tour in nearly a year. I mean, there was no chance this was going to happen. Even when he was staked to a 5-shot lead on Saturday, I either turned to you or one of our other peers, and I said, it's only a question of whether he's going to lose by 1, 2, or 3. I mean, there was zero chance that Phil Mickelson was going to win this golf tournament. And yet, what did he do, Rex? I mean, this was a performance where on occasion he was still, I mean, absolutely smashing his driver. But I thought overall he played conservatively, at least for Phil. He played with great poise. He played, I thought, with a lot of conviction. Conviction meaning he was very intentional in what he was trying to do. It was very methodic, to put it nicely. I mean, he was staying there behind the ball, visualizing for 10, sometimes 15 seconds, just standing there, picturing the shot, flexing his hand, blinking slowly, and then he would pull off the shot that he was trying to hit. And so, you know, this is kind of the breakthrough that Phil's been waiting for. And I think it's right up there with Muirfield in 2013 in terms of Phil's most impressive victories. I mean, that one was kind of unexpected because he had to completely abandon his swashbuckling style and learn a style of golf that he never in a million years would have thought that he could have played well with. This one was impressive just for the sheer fact that it came out of nowhere. Where do you put it in terms of the Open, which I think even Phil would describe as kind of a career defining achievement?
Well, it was interesting, the context of the legacy, right? So I don't know wherever it is you had him ranked before this, and I don't know what that would be like, but I was struck by, I was speaking with his manager, Steve Loy, after the fact, and Steve's been with him since college. He recruited him to come play in college, and now he's his manager, and he's very much more than a manager. He's a best friend. But out of the blue, Steve said, you know, maybe this moves him into the top 10 all time. And I was just struck by the idea that, well, is that where we're aiming now? Like, I don't know that, does that get him there? Because I think when you put this in context, and I wrote this in my column tonight, that someone asked me in a radio interview, would Phil winning this weekend compared to Jack in 86 winning at the Masters? And I don't think it does. I mean, I think that was a different time at 46 years old. I think everyone thought Jack was done. And then someone asked me, well, does it compare to Tiger winning the Masters just 2 years
ago?
No. Absolutely not. And I kind of came to the conclusion that, but it's right after those two. I don't know what else I could possibly put over that. And that's really good company when you start talking about some of the best, some of the most motivating victories of all time. This isn't the victory that I think would really seal that his fate, his legacy. I mean, that's obviously the U.S. Open, and I'm still dubious he could ever pull that one off. But this one, yeah. But I would think that Steve's right. I think this does move him into the top 10 all time if he wasn't already there, you know, in your mind, whatever your personal rankings are, because he was 50 years old and because all the things that you pointed out, that he was so far removed. Like, no one thought that this would be the golf course he could possibly do this on. I mean, it's an amazing feat.
Yeah, and I'm totally in agreement with you. When you think of Tiger in 2019, that was such a seismic achievement in the sense of what he had come back from just two years earlier. I mean, he was in such dire shape that he had to go to the bathroom in a bucket, and his kids were finding him face down in the backyard, unable to move. I mean, that was literally 2 years before he won at Augusta National. So this one doesn't even sniff that. You think of Jack in 86, and yes, people had written him off by that point. But he was also like 5 years removed from any sort of serious contention. I mean, Phil, he didn't have a realistic chance to win a WGC last year, but he still finished in a tie for second. I mean, he's popped up on occasion, and players that great, this is kind of what we've learned, is that they've always got 4 days in them. I mean, they, regardless of what they've done over the past couple of months, I mean, they always have that type of sublime form still left in that body, whether even if you're going to turn 51 in a month's time. And if you listen to players on the PGA Tour, you know, who play consistently with Phil or play money games with Phil, I mean, there is still a lot of game in that body. I think you really have to give him credit. And I wrote this in the column for golfchannel.com on Sunday night. The flabby Phil of 2006 would not have lasted this long. You know, Phil understood that he needed to transform his body and his game. And so he's shed all that fat. He's got a six pack now. He looks absolutely terrific. He's kind of kept up with the Joneses in terms of, you know, he's really adopted this modern game, which is all built on speed and on power. He's still swinging at 118, 119 miles an hour. He's still teeing it high and letting it fly. He's as flexible as ever. He really hasn't battled any serious injuries, or at least any that have significantly affected him more than perhaps the arthritis diagnosis about a decade ago. And so this is really a testament to Phil's physicality. And I thought, you know, yes, I would put him now on the precipice of the top 10 players of all time, if not inside the top 10. But I think the bigger point in Phil's legacy is going to be this. He's never been world number one. He's never won a money title. He's never won a FedEx Cup. But Phil has the most longevity in the history of the game. His 30 plus years between victories is the longest in PGA Tour history. You know, that's something that I'm not sure will ever be topped. And I think that is what's going to be his defining legacy. I still think the US Open is probably going to be a bridge too far.
Well, I started
going to be remembered. It's for his longevity.
Well, I tried to break the internet because at some point, you know, you try to put this in some sort of context. And the one that immediately comes to mind is Tom Brady, right? 41 years old, winning the Super Bowl, way past the age when a quarterback should ever be able to compete in that league because of the physicality and everything you put your body through. You can keep going down the road and kind of point the guys in the NBA or Major League Baseball, whatever the case may be. Jamie Moyer comes up as a pitcher who just seems ageless.
Jamie Moyer. Wow. I have not heard that name in years.
I told you, I broke Google trying to figure out how am I going to work this into the story. Never was able to figure out how to work it into the story, by the way. But it is interesting to me because you're right. I don't know that Phil was ever going to be bothered by those things you just mentioned, not being world number one, not winning the money title, not winning a FedEx Cup. However, this is one of those things he's going to brag about. We all know Phil. Like, he's the guy that shows up on Tuesday at Augusta and starts teasing guys about where you're going to eat tonight. Right. So, I mean, it's because just to rub in the point that, do you have a green jacket? I've got a couple. Do you want to borrow mine? Is that what you want? And this is going to be one of those things. And that's what he loves. I mean, one of the anecdotes that I led my column with that I thought was great, that even though maybe in our minds, clearly in our minds, since we didn't mention him at all on a 50-minute podcast on Wednesday night, he had slipped into a role, whether if we wanted to admit it or not, of a ceremonial golfer. I mean, he was just there biding his time at 50 years old. Like, this is what he's going to do. In his own mind, though, he had never done it. He was still that same kid from Southern California that was, you know, betting people coats as a 12-year-old, you know, that they get out drive them. And it came to sort of a head on Monday at a money game. And it was him and Steve Stricker, who, by the way, are combined 104 years old. And they were playing Zach Johnson and Will Zalatoris, who is 24 years old, just to put, again, in context. And the two old guys with three up through three holes, and Phil turned to Stricker loud enough for everyone to hear, obviously, and said, "Strix, I got to tell you, I thought we'd be better than three up through three holes." That's Phil. And that's the beauty of him. I mean, it's even at 50 years old, even when everyone else thought that, oh, he's a ceremonial golfer, he's just here for show, he still thinks he can win. And I mean, he proved us wrong, right? Because we all doubted him, and for all the good reasons, but it's that competitive spirit. It's that thing that he wants to give you the needle. It's that he wants to be able to walk in the room now and say that, who won the major in here at 50 years old? Oh, just me. Okay, I get it. And that's the beauty of Phil.
Yes. I mean, his will to win, his competitive spirit. I asked Tim Mickelson, his brother, about that. And he said, that's just the hallmark of the best players in the world. I mean, Phil just has happened to have it for 35 years, but don't you think in the back of Phil's mind that he did believe that his winning days were over? I mean, you have to think about what's gone on the last couple of years. And you've done a lot of great reporting on this with the Super Golf League and the Saudis, you know, the dalliances with the Saudis. He's talked about his calves and the coffee, and he's forever pitching those. He's talked about hellacious seeds and activated thumbs. He's become something of a social media sensation at age 50. I mean, it's all made for a lot of social media fodder, but there's no substance to it. And it almost reeked of a guy who's in the midst of a midlife crisis. I mean, he's essentially your age. And if you were doing some of those things on Twitter or Instagram, like your kids would be cringing. Like, it's just like, oh, dad, like, come on, knock it off. You're too old for doing that stuff. Like, it seemed like he's this fading star who is battling for relevance. And I pointed out in the column tonight, at this tournament last August, so that was 9 months ago, on Saturday of the PGA Championship, Phil Mickelson was in the booth with CBS wearing the headset and essentially auditioning for the lead analyst role. He spent basically an hour just dunking on Nick Faldo and kind of wowing us and saying, wow, this is clearly Phil's second chapter. This is what he wants to do. And even Steve Loy, who you mentioned earlier in the podcast, he confirmed to Hollywood Reporter earlier this year that, yeah, it would be a surprise if Phil is not donning a headset in the next year or two. That's what he said just a couple of months ago. I mean, this was a guy who clearly was viewing his winning ways, his winning days in the past. And he was looking at something else to do. And I think, honestly, like this changes everything for him. I mean, he's got a 5-year exemption now into all the majors. This was a guy who had to accept a special exemption of the US Open next month. I mean, he's now just outside the top 30 in the world. Like, this changes everything. This changes everything in terms of his competitive playing future for at least the next 5 years.
Well, it extends his career during a time when probably no one outside of Phil thought it was going to extend his career. And look, every tour player who's struggling will tell you, I'm close. That's their fallback. I mean, they always have to be close, right? That's the psychological game they have to play, because if they admit that, yeah, I'm not close, I'm lost, I don't know what I'm doing out here, then that you're going down a bad road on that one. And so my question would be, in his heart of hearts, that all of this time that he keeps telling us that he has been close, did he really believe it? Because
no
I
chance.
Would think
no chance.
And yet here we are, and this goes back just a few weeks ago, 2 weeks ago to Charlotte, when he talked endlessly about I'm close. And the other part of that is I'm having a hard time focusing. I lose concentration on the golf course. You talked about everything he did this week, just seemingly get over that. And it was standing behind the ball, and it's all these mental gymnastics to try to stay focused in. And I kind of dismissed that, and I still do to a certain degree, because I think, like every golfer who says they're close, that was another just excuse that this is the way I'm going to talk myself into I'm close. It's not my game. It's not my swing. It's not my body. It's I just have a hard time focusing for 18 holes. Once I figure that out, I'll be fine. And like talking with Steve Loy, and he kind of put it into the parameters of maybe it was the noise that he was having a hard time keeping out. And that I can believe, because there's
what kind of noise? No one's talking about it. There's no noise. No one's talking about him.
Sometimes good, sometimes bad. You brought up the Super League. He has been at the center of this, whether he has liked it or not, or whether or not, even if he wanted to be at the center of it, but he's the one that everyone has pointed to walk away. That creates noise. I think him getting the exemption into the U.S. Open, that created noise. I think people over the last 3 days, you and I, who doubted him being able to pull it off. And look, it's just not you and I. I traded text messages on Thursday night with a tour player asking me, what's the over-under on Phil's round on Friday? And he set it at 74.5, and I took the over. How am I doing?
Do you think the asking price for the Saudi Golf League or the Super Golf League just went up exponentially?
I don't have a lot of interest in talking about the Super Golf League right now, but based on what happened last week, and I mean, just it seems to me they overplayed their hand. And at best, that meeting last week was clumsy, and at worst, it might have been deadly. I don't know that we're going to talk about that anytime soon, based on what I've been told.
Thank you, Jesus. Rex, when we did the Masters recap pod, with Hideki Matsuyama claiming the green jacket, we actually had a lot of positive feedback from people who were interested in our process, how we kind of went through a major Sunday. You walked the front nine today when all hell was breaking loose and there's 2 and 3 shot swings on seemingly every hole. I walked the back nine. Take me through your experience, because this was the first major championship since August 2019, in which there was a significant number of fans out there.
And you felt it, and guys talked about it, and you're going to address it, because, I mean, I think that was a big part of what happened on 18. But I got the idea, and it suddenly dawned on me. And look, I think both of us came into this with the same mindset on Sunday morning, that this is Brooks to lose. I know he's trailing by a stroke, and I know Phil seems to be hitting some sort of stride, but I think we both felt that, okay, this is up to Brooks. Like, he's going to decide how this goes. And he birdies the first, and Phil bogeys the first. And suddenly I start thinking to myself, is he going to win by 4 or 5? Brooks, of course, is what I'm thinking at that point, because this is Brooks in full flight. This is what he does when he gets, you know, he gets the master, he gets a major in his jaw on a Sunday, and he's not going to let it go. And then there's these massive flips. And as we make our way through the front nine, and the gallery builds and they're screaming and everything's happening, it dawns on me that I think the crowd fears Brooks, but they love Phil, which is such a weird dynamic, because there would be almost uncomfortable, polite applause when Brooks would do something. But then when Phil would do something, it would be like full boisterous. I'm going to lean into this. I'm going to own this because I love Phil, but that other guy scares me.
And I actually thought Brooks was going to thrive in that environment, because he was clearly playing second fiddle, and Brooks does not handle that type of situation well. Like, you could just envision a scenario very easily in which he was viewing that as some sort of slight and just kind of adding chips to his already broad shoulder, and was just going to absolutely steamroll Phil. Like, if you look at Brooks over the past 4 years, he has vanquished basically every star in the game. He beat Tiger at Belrive. He beat Dustin at Bethpage. He's beaten Justin Thomas. He's beaten Rory. I mean, he's beaten anybody and everybody.
And all comers.
And he had to have been salivating at the prospect of taking this sentimental storyline, stomping on it, and just absolutely obliterating old man Mickelson. Like, it was easy to envision that scenario. And yet Brooks was the one who looked kind of rattled. I mean, it was Brooks who was hitting these wild foul balls. And it was clear walking the back now with Brooks that his knee was starting to bother him. I'm not sure if he started to grimace and limp a little bit more once it was clear that he had a poor round going. I don't particularly want to go there, but it was clear that he was missing left. And when he's missing left, that is when Brooks can't get into his left side. Like he's just hanging back and slapping it left. And so that's kind of what it appeared to me. And Phil, in my opinion, was fortunate that he wasn't more seriously pushed by Brooks on Sunday, because that front nine was wild and it really could have gone one of two ways. And Brooks not applying pressure, particularly on the par fives, is I think where Phil won this championship.
Well, yeah, he chips in, I believe, on the fifth hole, and then converts a birdie putt on the par five. And by that time, the crowd is behind him. He's got wind in his sails. But I will say this. So you transition to the back, makes the turn. He's up two strokes. But I think we're probably under the same mindset, because you wrote this, a good column on going into Sunday about how everything turned on 13. And you have to admit, and when he stepped to that tee on 13, you were thinking to yourself, it's going to happen again.
No, there was no way he was going to do that at the tee. I was more surprised by the second shot and why you would have even brought in the water hazard on the right side. I mean, just flare that left. At worst, you're going to make a five. If you pull it in the water, then you're potentially looking at double. So I thought that was a huge miscue. And then I kind of had a feeling, you know, Louis also made a mess of that hole. And then when you get 14 through 18, and Jordan Spieth, to his credit, previewed this a day earlier and said that closing stretch for Phil is going to be very fortuitous and that he is probably going to be in better position to attack than a right-hander would. And sure enough, Phil didn't necessarily hit great shots coming down the stretch. And in fact, it was, you know, a little bit sloppy. He missed what was a pretty simple putt on 15. He had a good chip on 16, 17, you know, he's kind of laying up from the tall grass there. And then on 18, I thought he had a great shot. But I think he was aided by the conditions, certainly. And he could kind of use his mid-iron play, his long iron play to his advantage. You know, that's kind of always been the hallmark of Phil's game. And once he got through the 13th hole, I believe he was four shots ahead at that point.
Yeah,
four. After Louis' mistake. I mean, you're just playing to avoid disasters at that point. Bogeys weren't going to kill him, and they eventually did not. And so walking up the 18th, you know, we still didn't know what Louis was going to do up ahead. And if Louis birdies the 18th hole downwind, which was a distinct possibility, Phil playing the 72nd hole with a one-shot lead is a whole different matter. And I was standing there with Alan Shipnuck, and you know, we were talking, and I said, those fans in the left grandstand better watch out, because this ball is headed straight to the grandstand. If you're standing on the 72nd hole, there is nothing but trouble, right? I mean, really deep bunkers, really long grass. You can see like all the TV studios there, like the bailout is to the left. And that grandstand was situated there 10, 15 yards from the left edge of the fairway. And that's kind of where they ran into problems here that we can get into with what went down, is that the fans were so close. They were so close to the action. And when Phil ripped one down there and he was safe and he was in the left rough, I mean, all hell was going to break loose. I think obviously it caught a lot of people off guard, but that was a perfect storm to have an absolute nightmare on the hands of volunteers and the few sheriffs who were there. They were kind of overwhelmed at that moment.
All right, well, and I want you to set the stage, because I'm standing sort of on the other side of the barrier behind 18. I was talking with some players, Ricky Fowler and Paul Casey, had kind of congregated to watch it. So I'm trying to get a sense of the scene and talk to them. But give me, like, set the stage. So Bill hits his approach shot to by the way, the fat of the green, where he two-putted for victory, which
sounds like. This thing began long before that.
You mean the crowd reaction. All right,
yes.
Then go ahead. Yeah.
Okay. So I'm standing before the tee box. Phil hits it. I mean, it was a fine tee shot, barely just found the left rough. And so by the time Phil actually reaches the fairway, I'm maybe 10 yards behind him, 15 yards behind him. And, you know, I'm kind of, you're supposed to stay one arm's length from the ropes. And so I'm scribbling notes as fast as I can, thinking of leads, thinking of details that I want to have in there. And so I'm jotting it furiously in my notebook. And then I look to my left, and all of a sudden, these kids, they're probably 20, somewhere, 20, 25 years old, clearly a little bit overserved. They duck under the ropes. And we'd kind of seen that over the past couple of holes. I didn't think much of it. And then, normally the cops kind of shoo them away. You guys aren't credentialed. Make sure you stay out of there. Well,
and we had a little bit of that on the front nine. It definitely happened on eight, where the sheriff's deputies had to sort of scoot some people back in out of the fairway.
Yeah. I mean, people want to be involved. They want to put it on Snapchat. They want to put it on Instagram. They want to tweet about it. I get it. You want to take pictures. You want to see how far you can get. It's fine. Well, the problem is these emboldened few quickly turned into a dozen, which turned into a couple dozen, which then turned into hundreds, which then turned into thousands. And so you have maybe five volunteers who are walking along with this group, and you had maybe 3 to 5 Charleston County sheriffs who were walking alongside this group. Like, they were ill-prepared. They were unequipped to handle just an absolute onslaught of people. And so when this cop in particular, who I had a previous run in a couple holes earlier, for no particular reason, he was getting overrun by this group. He's putting his hands on me, and he threw me out of the way. I said, "Dude, I'm media." He's like, I can't keep all these people straight. He was screaming for help. I mean, he goes, "They're coming. I can't stop them." It was like a hurricane. And he was just putting his hands up, just trying to stop the storm surge. And he just ended up getting bowled over. Like, he wasn't physically hurt or anything, but I mean, a uniformed cop got absolutely bowled over in the middle of the 18th fairway. And so at that point, all bets were off. You had thousands of people in the 18th fairway. And to be totally honest with you, and I kind of do scare easily, as you know.
Shitty mouse.
It was a little bit unsettling. I wasn't at East Lake in 2018. You were when Tiger had that breakthrough win after so many years. Just watching that on TV, that seemed more orderly. This was pandemonium. I mean, this was pent up energy of 15 or 16 months in your house. And now you can be maskless and at a sporting event, and you can drink and you can be rowdy. That's what this came down to. And it was absolute pandemonium. It was chaos. And so I ended up, there was a cop in front of me. I ended up, I told him so he didn't tase me. I said, "I'm going to grab the back of your belt and I'm going to ride you like you were the fullback and I'm the lead tailback." And sure enough, he bulldozed me right through the crowd, and we ended up getting to where Phil was. And I put this in my story, and I thought it was a little bit weird, because you were at East Lake, and you can kind of correct me if I'm wrong here. But when the masses kind of overflowed that 18th hole at East Lake, Rory and Tiger, like, they tried to run to stay ahead of the crowd. Like, they didn't want to get swallowed up. And Phil didn't do that. He didn't make any attempt whatsoever to kind of avoid the onslaught. He did his like slow, languid pace, like he'd done basically the entire day. So I didn't know if he was like basking in the moment. I didn't know if he just figured it was a lost cause and that they were going to overrun them anyway. But it became a little bit strange of a situation on the 72nd hole of a major championship. Brooks Koepka didn't make it to the 18th hole for 2 or 3 minutes afterward. And quite frankly, he was quite pissed afterward. he said, you know, people were taunting him. They were dinging up his right knee. He was a little bit salty afterward, and Phil had, you know, was absolutely not apologetic whatsoever. To me, that was obviously a joyous occasion, and it felt like the first real celebration of this post-COVID era. But it also was a little bit unsettling, a little bit unnerving, I think, for everyone involved, and especially for someone like me who's just kind of trying to document the action.
Well, you brought up Eastlake, and as I was talking with Ricky Fowler, we were kind of witnessing from the other side, sort of the crowd coming around the green, and I think both of us was sort of struck by it, and Ricky immediately called it Eastlake 2.0, but he was doing it more in reference to this is one of those moments that you're going to remember. And I don't know if he was saying that, you know, Tiger's victory at Eastlake was greater than Phil's. I don't think he was saying that. It was just a different version of it. It wasn't until that we literally saw there was some sheriff's deputies who were around the clubhouse, until we saw them running from the clubhouse going towards the green, that we realized, oh, this is a problem. Like, this isn't going to work out well. And at Eastlake, Tiger did stay ahead of it. Rory did stay ahead of it. Joe LaCava, Tiger's caddy, did not. And he has told this story numerous times about how once he kind of got lost in the crowd, and he usually has, you know, a police escort in those types of situations, he lost his police escort. There was some concern on, you know, for him in that particular situation. And you're right that Brooks was not happy at all. I don't know if it's fair to say he wasn't happy specifically because of the crowd. I think the crowd just added to an unhappiness that sort of went with the day. He didn't perform, he lost, all those things that go into it. But yes, it was a surreal moment, and they weren't prepared. And I say that only, not as overly to be overly critical of the PGA of America. I say that to just illustrate the things that you pointed out, that it was a very boisterous crowd all week long for the reasons that we've talked about, that people have been locked up for too long. And they haven't been able to drink in public, and they haven't been able to be mashed potato guy. And they were going to make the most of their opportunity to be mashed potato guy. And that's what we ended up with on the 18th green.
Yeah. And like, I'm not trying to be too woke here. Like, I'm not trying to be soft. Like, it was an absolutely incredible experience, something that I'll remember forever, you know, kind of being swallowed up in that sea and being witness to, history-making moment with Phil Mickelson at age 50 winning a major championship. I mean, this was
as
a record
you screamed
that stood...
to a police officer, "I'm with the media, save me." Is that how it went? That's how it went down, didn't it? Please,
I mean,
"I'm with the media, save me."
I was very nice at first, kind of nudging my way along, and then I realized that was going nowhere, and said, and so I was gonna hitch my saddle to this burly fella, and I said, come on, Captain, steer me to safety here. And so we just bludgeoned our way through the crowd. Like, it was an incredible moment. I kind of wished it was slightly more orderly, like it was at Eastlake, because this was a little bit unhinged at times, but it's certainly a memory that even Phil said he's going to cherish for a long time. Let's
gotta have sharp elbows,
on,
man. You got to have sharp elbows in that situation.
I mean, at 5'9" and 3/4", sharp elbows is basically all that I have to stand on. Let's hit real quickly on some of the other storylines. Brooks, this is a player who injured his right knee about 2 months ago, underwent surgery for a dislocated kneecap. Did well just to kind of make it through 36 holes at Augusta National, where he missed the cut. Kind of like Phil, not a whole lot of expectations for Brooks heading into the PGA Championship based on what we'd seen in limited action, just the two rounds the previous week at Byron Nelson. Were you surprised to see him, first of all, just in the final group with a chance to win another major?
I think so. I mean, because let's face it, when we saw him play at Augusta, he clearly shouldn't have been playing. He certainly shouldn't have been walking that particular golf course, and he didn't show many more signs of life in Dallas. But what you ended up with was something closer to what we've come to expect from Brooks in a major championship, when he puts that chip on his shoulder and he finds the different gear, and he's going to walk away and he's going to be pissed about this, because that's what he does. But I think there's a lot of positives for him to pull from this, because he admitted, I mean, he's, by his doctor's orders, he's 6 months away from being fully recovered. So just imagine, as he continues down this process, as he continues down this road, his knee gets better, he's able to be explosive. I did ask him on Saturday because he had mentioned that even though he was feeling better and he was making progress, that he said there's one out of every six drives that he just can't get off his right leg. And I think this goes to what you said about him start missing at left. And he said that through three rounds, it hadn't happened. So I think there's some positives. I think you can look at some silver linings. You can't say that about everybody who came and went from that place. Now, he's going to complain about his putting. I would argue that I don't think anybody putted particularly well. It was a combination of pollen greens and very high winds. So I don't think he needs to spend too much time thinking about that.
Why was Brooks so surly this week? You know, he rarely smiled.
This week
in particular, I thought he was particularly surly. I thought he was particularly kind of living up to that tough guy image that he tries so hard to project.
No, I mean, the too cool for school stuff he laid on. And this is just me guessing, but I'd say there was probably a combination of putting himself back in that situation and maybe needing to lay it on thick to convince himself that, look, it's me against the world. And you're right. The crowd probably didn't help that because they were clearly behind Phil. And it's probably a combination of the right knee hurts, man. I mean, it's not healthy. I mean, we both asked about what's the process like every night. There's a lot of therapy. There's a lot of icing. There's a lot more therapy. And if you're uncomfortable, if you're in pain, if you're limping around, if you're trying to play a professional sport, that's probably not a very good place to be.
Yeah. Brooks said that he wanted to prove to himself that he could get back in time for the Masters. I think this was trying to prove to everyone else just how historically great of a player he is here at the PGA Championship. He ended up finishing two shots behind. More surprising to you, Rory McIlroy, the winner of the PGA Championship last time a major was held here in 2012, finishing T49. His first start since Quail Hollow, or Jordan Spieth bidding to capture the career Grand Slam, tying for 30th, which was more surprising?
Rory. And look, Jordan was playing well. I mean, he's your boy, so I'm not going to down talk Jordo because this will turn into a 30-minute back and forth that I don't have any interest in as I travel down I-95. But Rory is clearly the one that all the expectations were on him. And I mean, I'm not.
But they shouldn't have been. They shouldn't have been. And we talked about this in the preview podcast. There's zero logical sense why Rory was the favorite for this golf tournament. Zero.
I mean, the wise guys usually don't get it wrong. I mean, I don't want to sit here and argue about what Vegas knows or what they don't know. When we went through this, I did pick him as my favorite simply because it was kind of a point of diminishing returns with everyone else that we mentioned, because we clearly didn't mention the winner, but you could, Dustin Johnson wasn't putting well. Brooks Koepka had knee issues. Jordan Spieth didn't seem like he was 100% back. Rory McIlroy had won 2 weeks earlier and knew how to play this golf course. That being said, I mean, he continues to say things that raise alarm bells. I mean, when he talks to the media and talks about how I still have so far to go, and he spoke to the media today and talked about how his driving is just bad right now. It used to be his greatest weapon, and it's slowly but surely becoming his biggest liability. That's an issue. And I think because the expectations, at least in my mind, and again, he was the favorite, so I would say in most people's minds, those expectations were so high, to hear him walk out of this place with those kind of concerns, with those kind of comments, that's something that I'm going to worry about.
Who has a better finish at Torrey? Phil? Jordan or Rory?
That's good. If I had to pick right now, I would probably pick Jordan. I just like the way his game is, because Phil doesn't like Torrey Pines. I mean,
he does not at all.
He doesn't. I mean, we won't get into it because, you know, it's his home and it'll be a feel-good story, and the San Diego boys coming home, and maybe he can complete the career Grand Slam. There'll be so many other bright and shiny things that we as journalists are going to just grab at, because that's the easiest thing to do. He doesn't like the golf course. He really hasn't since the redesign, you know, for the Open in 2008. That's why he has skipped it from time to time. And he doesn't like what San Diego, the city, did when he tried to make his bid to redesign the North course. And he was kind of boxed out for some sort of political reasons that I still don't understand to this day. So, I mean, he's going to go play. He took the special exemption. He would have qualified anyway now based on the win. But I guarantee that he won't be on our radar on that Wednesday night when we do that podcast either.
Do you think that Phil, in his pre-tournament press conference at the U.S. Open, is going to drag the Wanamaker, which looks like it's 150 pounds. You think he's going to drag that in there, make sure Mike Davis is attending that presser, and then take the invitation to this tournament and just light a match to it and just snicker? Because you know that he swallowed his pride, and that was the last thing he wanted to do, was accept an invitation into our national championship. At a golf course that he doesn't particularly like anymore, at the tournament that he's never won and has tormented him, and it's run by an organization that has, you know, occasionally roiled him and kind of sent him to do some wacky things like hit a moving ball back at Shinnecock. How is he going to handle this? Because I can see him doing Phil things in that press conference.
I'm not 100% sure he's going to give a press conference because he's taken to not.
He has to. He's the PGA champion.
All right. We'll see how that plays out. We'll do an over under on Monday night about that one as well. But if he does, no, I don't think he would dip into those waters. And to your point, you're right. That was a hard invitation for him to take, because not so much the championship itself, but the USGA. And he just don't see eye to eye. They never really have. And this was something that he probably spent a lot of time thinking about. People who were close to him have told me that he really didn't want to take it, that he almost didn't take it. So, yes, I think you're right on that front. But no, because he won't create those distractions. When we talk about noise, when we talk about all these things he's trying to do on the golf course, whatever you want to call them, lapses in concentration, noise, whatever, that would be too much noise about something that he doesn't need to worry about that particular week, knowing what he has on the line. And I'm going to end up writing the exact same column I think I have written 5 times in the past, which is the U.S. Open has moved on without Phil. There's no way he's going to win it, but now that he's done what he's done here, I'm going to have to write it again. I mean, I'll just cut and paste and put a different name in and change the date and his age and be done with it.
Who's your way too early pick for the U.S. Open?
Didn't I just kind of pick Jordan? I would probably pick Jordan. John Rahm was the one I was thinking about, and it was this afternoon. And as bad of a week as he had, and he might have given one of the most entertaining. It wasn't. You can't call it a press conference. It was kind of a hissing radiator of, why am I on this stage? Why did you ask me to come up here? I don't care about what you're asking me right now. I'm just gonna walk away. But he does that. But I mean, he plays that place so well. He loves that place. He proposed to his wife there. He's won there before, and I think eventually he's going to get a major. Why not that one?
Yeah, I actually agree with you on this one. I think John Rahm is a prohibitive favorite, actually, at the U.S. Open. I absolutely love the shirt that he was wearing when he came back to the golf course to congratulate Phil Mickelson on his PGA Championship victory. He was wearing a shirt that was very relatable. It said "Dad Bod." So that was extremely relatable. Normally at this point of the podcast, Rex, you ask me what I'm smoking this week. I got to ask you, what are you smoking this week? Because you have quite a menu that you have to prepare on Saturday.
As we walked people last week, at the Masters, walked us through the creative process. Just to give you another little glimpse, we spent the better part of this morning. I should say you spent the better part of this morning trying to figure out if I can cook a pork butt, if I could smoke a pork butt the day before, because I'm going to need it. As you pointed out, my middle son graduates from high school on Monday. He is going to have his graduation party on Saturday, so a week from 2 days ago. And he wants me to cook all of these things. He wants wings, he wants burgers, and he wanted pulled pork. I can't do all of those things in one day. I'm not a restaurant.
Impossible. Impossible.
It's impossible. I can't physically do it. So you spent all morning long coming up with a way. So I think I'm going to be able to do a pork butt or two, put them in the refrigerator overnight, and then pull them the next morning. I think I've got it down. I'm sure I'll have to call you about 1,000 times. So.
And you've got about 100 angry 18-year-olds if you do not pull this off successfully. So nothing could go wrong with that scenario.
What's going to go wrong?
Yeah, exactly. Rex, it was a terrific week here at Kiawah Island. If you've never been to this part of the world, it is absolutely glorious. We had a terrific week, much better, in fact, than even 2012 when we were staying on the island, did not endure the shuttle ride from hell. That's it for this edition of the Golf Central podcast presented by Callaway Golf. We'll be back next week to recap all the comings and goings from Colonial, where Finn Mickelson is in the field for now. And we'll see you next time.
I'm in Georgia.
Dietz and Watson's been making meats and cheeses the right way since forever. What's that mean? It means never cutting corners, ever. It means cooking, not processing. It means our Virginia brand ham that's cooked to perfection, then twice baked to layer the flavors. It takes more time, but you can taste the difference. We come to work every day to do it the right way, even if it's the hard way. Because if it's not right for us, it's not right for you. Dietz and Watson, it's a family thing since 1939.
Time for a quick break to talk about McDonald's. Mornings are for mixing and matching at McDonald's. For just $3, mix and match two of your favorite breakfast items, including a sausage McMuffin, sausage biscuit, sausage burrito, and hash browns. Make it even better with a delicious medium iced coffee. With McDonald's mix and match, you can't go wrong. Price and participation may vary. Cannot be combined with any other offer or combo meal. Single item at regular price.